I would like to draw this one to a close and get on with the next paper so that we can get out of here by 4 o'clock. There will be a movie taken of the next paper, and the lights shouldn't disturb you. So just continue like they've been.
That's an order, not a...
The next paper will be aimed at discussing the lunar surface data as gathered from Earth and from the unmanned space program, and how these data are being used in the Apollo landing site analysis program by the Manned Spacecraft Center. Mr. John Dornbach, chief of the Lunar Science Technology Branch of the Space Science Division, will present the paper. John?
This paper will discuss current data of the lunar surface and how we are using this data in evaluation procedures at MSC based upon the operational criteria which has just been covered by Mr. Bernard. In the paper, I shall concentrate mostly on available lunar surface data and how we are using this data in the current MSC landing site analysis program. In a general summary of conclusions which may be based upon this work, I think we can say that from Earth-based data and the surveyor data which we have even just seen a bit of, we can say that Apollo landing sites can be found in the orbiter areas, or the areas to be photographed by orbiter. We feel that operational mission flexibility can come from favorable lunar location of orbiter sites or data from these sites, and that analysis of the orbiter sites, orbiter A and B sites, based on today's operational criteria, shows that favorable locations are generally clustered around 30 degrees east longitude near the Zero Meridian and about 35 degrees west longitude. The first portion, I will concentrate on some of the data sources from Earth-based observation. I've here illustrated the 1-to-1,000,000 scale mapping program, that's 16 miles to the inch, which is currently underway at the Air Force Aeronautical Chart and Information Center in St. Louis, Missouri. These maps contain 1,000-foot contour lines. They based on shadow length measurement techniques on these photographs. The area shown in yellow, you can readily see, is very adequately covers the Apollo zone of interest. And I've illustrated here by one of the sheet line outlines, that of the Kepler quadrangle, the general area covered by each individual sheet. Now, these 1-to-1,000,000 scale base maps are used by the U.S. Geological Survey branch of astrogeology and Flagstaff in their geologic mapping program on this 1-to-1,000,000 scale. Now, this one illustrates the Kepler sheet I've indicated over here. You see the crater Kepler, and each of the various colors here pertains to a stratigraphic or geologic unit which they have indicated through their telescopic observation. Generally, you have the inner crater floor material, primary and secondary ejecta material. The purple color here is more or less Mori material, and the dotted patterns you see are ray materials coming from this impact crater. The Air Force Chart Center is also conducting a mapping program at a 1 to 500,000 scale, or 8 miles to the inch. They're concentrating on mapping chart detail in the Mori, or what appears to be the more flatter areas, and they are mapping every bit of information they can gain through telescopic observation down to about a quarter of a mile to a half a mile, depending on, of course, on viewing conditions. The area indicated by yellow has already been completed. The area in red, most of the chart should be out within 3 months to 6 months. So most of the Apollo zone of interest will be covered in the very near future. We are also utilizing information from other parts of the spectrum. You've noticed that the cartographers and geologists have mapped from the Earth how the moon varies from place to place in the visible spectrum. As the wavelength of instrumental observation is increased into the infrared, we see that around 10 microns wavelength, the moon begins to demonstrate anomalous characteristics. This slide by Shardhill and Sari illustrates that during an eclipse, as a source of energy, the sun is quickly removed, certain portions of the lunar surface retain heat longer than others. From this, we might infer that the areas retaining heat are rocky or covered by more dense material, whereas those which quickly cool could be covered with a less dense or highly insulating material. You notice we've tilted the Apollo zone of interest here to correspond to Shardhill's chart. He apparently produced the chart in order to show his scans as horizontal. The NASA is also conducting studies with Lincoln Laboratories of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in another portion of the spectrum. By examining the moon in the centimeter and meter radar wavelength regions, it should also be possible to infer differences from place to place as small as several square miles. From an analysis of the return signals, scientists expect to learn something of the density of materials making up the upper lunar mantle and the average roughness of the surface from place to place. By combining all data gathered from Earth with knowledge gathered from discrete samples from Surveyor and possibly Luna, we feel confident that satisfactory landing sites can be located on the orbiter photography. This slide, the Apollo zone of interest, is included to show how the unmanned program is concentrating much of its data gathering in this area. We've indicated by the outlines of the Ranger program those areas in which the resolution of the photography exceeded that from Earth-based observatories. We've indicated on here most of the surveyor sites, which have been previously analyzed by Gene Shoemaker's people as being potentially favorable for surveyor landings. And of course, you'll note the successful surveyor landing made at approximately this point. We've also indicated the Luna impact point. And we've indicated on this slide the Orbiter A mission, which you can see moves across. And number 10 was originally over in this area. Now it's been moved over to this point, and I'll say a little more about that later on. We'll also be discussing the Apollo Site 5 on Mission A a little more in detail. I'll use that as an example of the kind of work we've been doing here. And I also believe that Mr. Milwitzki could correct me on this, but I believe this site is being somewhat seriously considered as a potential site for the next surveyor. In our program here at MSC, we've received a great deal of information from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We've received magnetic tapes of some of the final pictures from each Ranger mission. We've used their programs for the enhancement or cleanup of the photographs and the rectification of the photographs. And we've established programs then to geometrically land a LEM on these topographic surfaces in order to see the kinds of tilts which the LEM would encounter on various of these photographs. Here we have the last three photographs from these two P cameras from the Ranger 9 mission. Remember, Ranger 9 landed in the crater floor of Alphonsus Crater. And I'd like to point out here that the first two photographs of each series contain this large crater here, which you see is about 200 feet across. The final two photographs from those two P cameras do not contain this large crater, or, in other words, we might say that this sort of demonstrates an average characteristic of the crater floor where a large crater isn't located. Now, if we look at the statistics which we've generated from these photographs, we see that in analyzing the photographs that contain the large crater, we find that more than 50% of the time we run into craters here that are between 10 and 15 degrees. However, if we take this surface in which the larger crater is not located, we find that more than 80% of the time we have slopes of less than 5 degrees, or the LEM would have encountered slopes of less than 5 degrees. We feel quite confident that with man in the loop making the landing, even with craters of this size within a landing ellipse or in a landing site, he could miss these kinds of craters. So I think this is fairly characteristic of what we will be looking for on orbiter photographs. We've also analyzed Ranger 8 photography in a somewhat similar manner. Here I've indicated one of the cleaned up and rectified images from the Ranger 8 program. You can see the scale of the photograph here we've been working with. On this map, we've sort of made an annotation of the cumulative data gathered from the photograph. You'll see all the areas here in the yellow and white are indicate slopes that the lunar module would have encountered of less than 8 degrees. The only areas being in excess would be this area of green and the one or two in the red color. Insofar as the bottoming hazards, again, only in the vicinity of these larger craters would we find any type of bottoming hazards, and in most cases they're less than the criteria which Mr. Bernard presented. The slides on the right simply illustrates in graphic form the information which is on this map, where you see, again, 80% or more of the tilts are less than 5 degrees, and most of the protuberance heights, when you get above about 40, are almost non-existent. As a further indication of the kind of information being generated through programs already in existence, I'd like to call your attention to the Ranger 9 photographs, again, of the northeast floor of the crater Alphonsus, and a geological map of these two photographs, which were prepared by Dr. Jack McCauley of the Geological Survey. Now, I think the importance here is to realize that as we get more detailed or larger scale photography of the lunar surface, the kinds of geologic maps that can be produced will be much more detailed and much more precise than those which we've been working with up to this point. So I think, Gene, you correct me if I'm wrong, but probably most of this area is not even seen on the 1 to 1 million scale chart that's currently in existence. They've shown the older geologic unit as related to Imbrian material by this purple, and the older crater floor material or more highly pockmarked material is indicated by the white pattern. The crater, inner crater walls, in which they've indicated swampage or sinking of the walls, are indicated this, and they designate the difference between what they believe to be an impact versus volcanic crater. The orange material outlines the inner crater of impact metamorphism, the green indicating one which is perhaps of volcanic origin. To illustrate another example of the kind of evaluation which is being conducted with the photography, this is an analysis of bearing strength by Dr. Jared Kuiper of the University of Arizona, who was principal investigator for the Ranger photography. He made several basic assumptions, and from his basic assumptions, estimated the bearing strength of this cratered surface. He examined many protuberances and indicated them on this Ranger 9 photograph by small arrows. He summarized that these were materials ejected from the 150-foot diameter primary crater shown over on the left of the photograph. The materials measured at the 10-degree sun angle appeared to be about 3 feet across and about a foot high. Assuming they were ejected from the primary crater to where they are found and that their bulk density was about 2, he concluded that the objects that you still find on these photographs were apparently about half squashed and perhaps half buried. From this, then, he concluded that the bearing strength of the materials should be about 14 pounds per square inch, average for the upper 1 to 2 feet of this part of the lunar surface. Now, I'd like to go on at this point and discuss some lunar surface data, which is perhaps a bit more definitive. First of all, I'd cover the Luna 9 vehicle, which was perhaps our first tactile sample of the moon. The Luna 9 probably gave us our first glimpse that we're not, in essence, dealing with a surface of deep dust or dust in which this spacecraft would have gradually sunk out of sight, but we are dealing with a surface which is relatively similar to what great many people working on the program have predicted. This sketch on the left is a composite of much of the information which has been interpreted from an analysis of the photography, and it's made by combining work which was in the material published by the U.S. Geological Survey on their analysis, plus work which we've done in-house. By locating conjugate images on two mirrors and a direct photo image, we were able to determine distances to the materials photographed. From this distance, we could determine that the size of particles 3 to 5 feet from the spacecraft were about 0.2 inches in size. The larger objects are 10 inches to a foot. The crater on the left horizon is approximately 50 feet in diameter. That's this one over in here. I've included this slide to illustrate some of the problems we encounter when working with photography taken close to the surface. We assume the Luna 9 spacecraft camera to have been only about 22 inches or less above the lunar surface. Due to the small mirror base of about 12 inches, reliable measurements are limited to a distance between about 3 to 20 feet. The Surveyor TV camera provided photographs from about 5.5 feet above the lunar surface. Also, a more precise knowledge of the Surveyor spacecraft, landing dynamics, camera calibration, and orientations should provide much more quantitative information than Luna 9. Now, on the photograph on the right, we've attempted to show the actual path of the two mirror images, which we located at this point and at this point, and you see they're indicated on this schematic diagram. From these, we've put a scale, or attempted to put a scale, on this photograph. The numbers indicate the distance between each line, so it'd be 50 centimeters from this line to this line, 50 centimeters from here to here, 50, 50, and then at this point, the distance between the two lines is about a meter, 2 meters, and finally 10 meters. So we're in this, these photographs, we were looking at material relatively close to the spacecraft. Now, I'd like to go on with a few Surveyor photographs, which Mr. Milwitzki was kind enough to permit us to use at this symposium. As you well know, the evaluation teams have as yet only published very preliminary materials, and when it comes to analyzing the tremendous amount of data and the 10,000 or so photographs, I think our nation's scientists are going to be quite busy for quite a long time. I've included these two slides to illustrate what we've been discussing to a certain degree, and that is the visibility problem. This sun angle here, and you see the spacecraft shadow. We've estimated this shadow to be about 35 feet long, and I believe this agrees with the evaluation at JPL. Now, the slide on the right is a close-up of just this region right in here. So I'd like to call it, now on you, we can see from, this is the camera location here, we can see that our textural detail in this region is much less than an angle off to either side. Now, if we move over to the right, then we have a field of view here of about 25 degrees. So we have sort of, I guess almost empirically, been using this 5-degree cone of dead band around the 0-degree phase angle point. So here you see the camera shadow that actually took the picture, and if we move about 5 degrees in either direction, we do in essence see something of a washout on either side, definitely the washout above this region. And if we look down into this region, or if we move over and look down into this area, you can see that with our viewing angle above the sun angle, the textural clarity here is very marked. Whereas as we approach the zero phase angle, we continue to have a fairly good definition of texture as long as our viewing angle is above the sun angle. The minute we get to the zero phase angle point and begin above it, again we begin getting the washout. Now, we'd be very happy, of course, to find that we could open up this lighting window. So let me again emphasize Owen Maynard's remarks, Mr. Mowitzki, that we're waiting anxiously for further evaluations. The next slide has been included to illustrate the kinds of material in which surveyor impacted. This is the spacecraft pad 2 and a close-up of this pad. The pads, these honeycomb structure, were depressed into the lunar surface between 1 and 2 inches, so it penetrated a very small amount. The kinds of materials we see here has been referred by some as simply calling it almost soil. It appears to be loosely cohesive. The particles that we're looking at here are down in just fractions of an inch. And I think it's noteworthy to point out here that the materials that appear to have been disturbed by the landing maneuver are a lower albedo than some of the other materials out away from the pad. Now, this is somewhat different than what we had anticipated, because we assumed that materials kicked out would give a lighter appearance, which then would be gradually darkened through solar radiation darkening. As quickly as this was noted, I think quite a few people began formulating their own special opinions as to why this takes place. But I think we better wait until someone publishes their results. I didn't quote a value for this. Hugh Scott quoted the 5 psi, and to put it in its proper context, I believe that the exact statement should be that they estimated a static bearing strength of 5 pounds per square inch at a penetration depth of about 1 inch. Now, we've included this one to not only demonstrate some of the photometric characteristics, but also discuss the kind of surface which we see here overall. You'll notice the sun angle here of 10 degrees, the sun angle here of 20. Now, this crater here was estimated to be about 10 feet across, 10 feet in diameter, and around between 1 and 2 feet deep. Now, over on this side, with a higher sun angle, you see it's not quite as visible. Now, we are aware, as Mr. Mowitzki says, as the sun gets higher, we're looking out away from the zero phase angle line. In other words, we're looking almost perpendicular to this point. So that at higher sun angles, we do get what we could call an enhanced image, but it's a somewhat foreign image in that we run into what we call photometric shadowing. So it wouldn't be unexpected to find this, but of course, to actually put some quantitative values on it, I think we'd be very happy to see these for 5.5 feet above the lunar surface. Now, I'd also like to point out, and I believe in the press conference in Washington, Gene Shoemaker discussed this at great length, such as they would provide time for, that it. You'll notice we have here a surface which appears to have many different size materials, except that the very fine materials only a few millimeters or fractions of an inch in size, make up by far the largest majority of material sizes. And we see here craters that are obviously of different types, that a crater such as this has a very pronounced lip. There's a low sun angle photograph of this one taken only a few degrees, with the sun a few degrees above the horizon right before sunset, that shows a very pronounced lip on this crater, whereas back in here we have a larger crater that appears to have not much lip at all, if any, but has a very strong rubble-strewn fringe around it. Now, from this, it's been surmised that the impact here occurred in a material, a finely pulverized, ground, and reworked material, it didn't penetrate deeper to reach a more dense or more cohesive underlying material. The impact which occurred at this point actually reached on below the level or layer of this rework region and reached a more dense or a more highly cohesive material. Now, I have included in my presentation a short movie which was produced by researchers at the Ames Research Center in conjunction with Dr. Henry Moore of the Menlo Park branch of astrogeology office. And they've studied high and low velocity impacts in their laboratory through use of special light gas guns and other devices. By relating their results to primary and secondary craters formed by atomic and explosive projectile explosions at various test grounds, Galt, Moore, and others have deduced that the principal small-scale crater-forming process on the Ranger photographs resulted from primary and secondary cratering in loosely cohesive materials. The following short movie, called Mare Carborundum by Don Galt, illustrates how much of this surface layer of the lunar landscape could have been formed by low-velocity secondary impacts in loosely cohesive materials such as dry sand. Other than the possibility of using a wider range of projectile sizes, Galt believes this simulation to be characteristic of the major process responsible for the particulate material making up the upper few feet of the surface as seen on the surveyor photographs. Now, this movie is of a 2-by-3-foot model. It has a sun angle about 15 degrees and is intended to represent a time scale of something like 10 to 100 years. The bed is dry sand, aluminum oxide sand for the perfectionists in the audience, and the overlying surface is a blue layer, which is about 2 centimeters, or a little more than 1/2 inch deep, underlain by a white material. The projectile sizes used here were something like 500 BBs at 300 foot per second velocity, 190 22 caliber projectiles at 1,200 feet per second, and a 1930 caliber projectiles at 3,000 feet per second. You'll notice that this large impact here will gradually disappear as the cratering process goes on and on. Again, that blue layer is 2 centimeters deep, and you'll gradually see this whole surface being worked and reworked through this cratering process. Now, Don Galt has told us in personal communications that he's in the process of revising this film. He's including 3 more smaller sizes, or smaller projectiles than BBs, and he believes that this will give a very profound effect on reducing the overall relief, but will be a little more exemplary, or more exemplum, of the kind of materials, kind of surface seen on the surveyor photograph. At the end of the movie, it'll go back to that original large crater that you saw in the central portion, and it'll give you an illustration of the kind of surface that has ultimately resulted. I heard someone whisper scale in the audience. I think this is about a foot or so across, so this would be the same related to the 1-to-1 scale on the lunar surface, according to Galt. Notice this large crater. Now I'll see the final result in that same area. I'd like to go on now and discuss a bit of the Orbiter project. You see here a slide of the Arbiter A and B mission sites. From an altitude of about 30 miles, the Arbiter will photograph areas about 22 by 56 miles in 8-meter resolution and 10 by 38 miles in 1-meter resolution on each photographic orbit. The A mission has 10 photographic sites, and the B mission has 11. In the A mission, sites 2, 4, and 6 are in upland areas, the remaining in Maury terrain, or generally in Maury terrain. On the B mission, sites 4 and 5 are in upland areas. Sites 7 and 9 are areas that are mixed, that is, they may contain a crater, Maury, or upland areas in various combinations, and the remainder generally in Maury terrain. The low-resolution photography will provide for stereoscopic analysis. Monoscopic or photometric slope analysis will be performed on the high-resolution photographs. It may be noted that two consecutive passes will be used on Mission A at this point in order to ensure that the area in which surveyor landed will be included in the photographs. Langley Research Center, the Lunar Orbiter Program Office, feels confident that the two consecutive passes will assure that the Surveyor 1 will be photographed in side-lap stereo on the high-resolution photography. We know at MSC that the number 9 and 10 is no longer used to designate these. I believe it's 8.1 and 9.1 or something of this sort, but we learned of this too late to change the slides. Now, in analyzing the Arbiter A and B sites in the site selection process as we've currently done at MSC, we've used all available information in an attempt to simply see what areas would be available for analysis once the Arbiter information was received. There'll be about 2,000 9 by 14 inch photographs from each Arbiter mission. And because of this, we feel it will be necessary to concentrate the search for acceptable landing sites in areas which will be most accessible according to the operational mission and spacecraft constraints as we know them at that time. Now, in analyzing these areas, we've first taken and gone over the Arbiter sites and looked for any slopes in excess of 10 degrees. We've categorized these and eliminated these areas. We've then taken areas of 6 to 10 degrees, categorized these, and also eliminated them. The reason we did it in two shifts, more or less, is that if our landing gear analysis program shows that we can tolerate 8, 9, or 10 degree slopes, we can put this category back into the program then real quick. We've also eliminated areas covered by craters of about half a kilometer up to 10 kilometers in diameter, because once they get larger than this size, there is a possibility we might be able to land inside of it, so we didn't want to reject it. These are about the smallest size craters we can see from Earth. And as a scale factor, this is slightly smaller than the Meteor Crater Arizona, so it's a sizable crater. We've taken also and used a 3 sigma dispersion ellipse, which is about the same size or slightly larger than, I think it's the 3 by 10 or 11 mile ellipse as used in some of the other papers. We've taken a look at smaller ellipses also, and I will discuss these. We've also analyzed all of these areas on the basis of 10, 20, and 30 mile radar approach paths. Now, I'm going to use Arbiter Site 5. This is the site I previously pointed out as being close to the 0-0 point, or the center of the visible side of the moon as we see it from Earth. This is the area covered by the high-resolution photography. This is the area by the low-resolution photography. And we've eliminated from this slide, those are indicated, those craters which met the criteria as indicated here. Going on, we've also made the assumption that in order to get contour or slope information with a fairly high confidence, we would like to have the radar approach path in the area covered by the low-resolution stereo photography of Arbiter. From the stereo photography, we can very accurately determine slopes. So if you, and using, as you see, a 30 nautical mile radar approach path and this large landing ellipse, we eliminated the area up to this point, mostly because of the 30 nautical mile path that has to come from the low resolution orbiter photography. Then in taking the landing ellipse, if we take and say we don't want to land, have in our landing ellipse a large crater which you can see from Earth, which means that it's about a half a mile or more across, the only ellipse we can actually fit into this area is this one right here. Now, I should point out again that we haven't attempted to say whether the area inside of this ellipse is landable or not from a topographic or geologic standpoint. We've simply said this would be available for further study on the orbiter photographs. Now, the U.S. Geological Survey is preparing several types of maps on each one of the orbiter sites, and I've indicated here a map of terrain features which they've prepared for orbiter site 5. The area that's shaded here is 1A, or undifferentiated Maury material, which I believe is similar in texture and appearance to that which we saw on the surveyor photograph. And on the basis of their analysis, all of this shaded area is this type of surface. The problem, you see, that we immediately find is that the Roman numeral 3s and 4s, which gets us into crater fields, ridges, domes, rills, etc., are concentrated back in this region, whereas in essence it appears that this would be, the, from a terrain feature standpoint, the most favorable area to locate an ellipse. This is what Owen Maynard referred to earlier, that we have analyzed all of these radars, all of these orbiter sites with smaller ellipse sizes and 10, 20, and 30 mile radar approach paths. And no matter what size ellipse, even taking a 3 by 7 kilometer ellipse, we found that the orbiter site, which appeared to be most favorable, held true independent of this ellipse site. And I have a slide later on which will show you what happens insofar as the radar approach paths are concerned. Now, this is a general summary of the analysis we've taken of the largest ellipse size. And here's our friend, the site 5, and here's our single landing ellipse. Now, if we fall back to only a 20-mile approach path, we find there are 5 favorable ellipses of this size. And in going to the 10, we go up to the quantity of 8. As I said before, we have parametrically analyzed also what happens with more ellipses, and generally speaking, the priority, or the numbers that contain the most favorable ellipses, stays pretty much the same. You can see 2, 4, and 6 over here were the ones we were using as photographed in the highlands to permit the geologists to better understand the genesis and morphology of the lunar surface. And these were never intended to contain sites in the first place. Similarly with several of the sites over here on the B mission. These tables will be published in the proceedings, so they will be available for detailed study. This is what results then in our list of priority sites, and this is what has led us to the belief that these sites generally tend to be clustered over here at about 30 degrees east, around the central portion, and then about 35 degrees west. And again, we've indicated here the area to be photographed by the A9 and A10 passes of Orbiter A of this landed surveyor site. Finally, I'd like to indicate here the data sources which will be feeding into the landing site analysis program at MSC. And you see here that the frequency distribution of slopes and the bottoming hazard frequency distribution program and the terrain analysis of the radar approach path will be done here at MSC. We'll be assisted in the topographic mapping, or contour mapping if you wish, by the Department of Defense agencies, the Air Force Chart Center in St. Louis, and the Army Map Service in Washington. The U.S. Geological Survey will provide us various scale photogeological maps from the surveyor evaluation teams from USGS also, and from some in-house work at MSC. We will get what you feel enough lunar soil mechanics property information to rate limb landability at these selected landing sites. Finally, somewhat further downstream, after the second, third, or fourth mission, somewhere along there, we'll probably be interested in specifically why do we want to go to certain places, what scientific interest, what can we do at one place versus another. I'm sure that once we feel that we can reach locations and that with our operational and mission constraints, the reasons for going to certain places will become more important. Lastly, the orbiter data screening process, a 30 days analysis of the orbiter photography to, in essence, assure that the people who have been estimating surface properties and doing terrain analysis have really been doing our homework correctly, and to make sure that Orbiter B, in essence, will look at the areas that stand a chance of containing topographically and geologically acceptable sites. Finally, this information will be forwarded after candidate landing sites are selected at Manned Spacecraft Center. The final selection of the lunar sites to be used for each Apollo mission will be made by the Associate Administrator for Manned Space Flight based on the recommendations of the Apollo Site Selection Board, which is chaired by General Sam Phillips, Office of Manned Space Flight. Thank you. I'm not real sure what the question was. I think it is something along the line as to why I use Site 5. Site A5 was purely a sample. It had no other purpose other than the fact that I had to make an example of some site, so I picked 5. It was nice in the middle, and it made a good location. It was in that list, in that location, because it contained one site and there were other sites that contained more based upon that analysis. If I had used other analyses by decreasing the ellipse size or decreasing the radar approach path, the order might have changed slightly, but not too significantly. Thank you. I'll have to go back to my source of information. I believe in our personal discussions, more or less, with the Langley people, I believe they can get more side lap than the amount of side lap you would anticipate through a normal photographing on the first and second pass. Now, whether they do this by tilting the spacecraft or exactly how they do this, I'm not certain, but I do believe it's based upon more than just the 5% overlap you would anticipate on a normal mission. So,
this can be done by tilting the camera.
Well, yes. Well, I'm not sure if they're going to play that game of attempting to tilt it, but I believe they anticipate more than 5% side lap. Right. Well, it's even after I think the all the calibration factors are given. Anytime you analyze a photograph, you stand the possibility of examining a photographic laboratory darkroom in a technician's nightmare, and you're really not analyzing facts. So I hope and I'm sure that the people who publish a revised photometric curve will be analyzing negatives made from as close a generation, or film positives perhaps, as close to the generation of the original data as possible, and not be looking at pretty pictures as we were. But this is all we've had at Manned Spacecraft Center up to this point. The question is, were there filters on the Surveyor spacecraft, and were you able to increase the detail on the photographs through the use of these filters?
Yes, there were filters on the spacecraft. The filters were primarily for colorimetry. But now they have the filters that can use to try to influence the current pictures. The effect on the contrast is not very significant. The reason for that is the moon is mostly gray.
Mr. Milwitzki answered that there were filters, but the filters were largely there for colorimetry. And since the lunar surface is basically gray, the filters appeared to have a small amount of effect upon the imagery that received. Beings, I'm supposed to know all kinds of things about the lunar surface, and nothing about that sort of thing. I'll defer the question to Owen Maynard.
I think the answer is no, primarily because it would represent an extra constraint out of which one would expect to get very little additional real value to the program. I'd hate to have one more constraint thrown in, which is to get into phase with some other spacecraft that was already in lunar orbit. That would just about kill us, I think. Any other comments, pearls of wisdom, general discussion? That illuminating question you were going to ask and didn't get around to earlier? The one without which the conference would not be complete? Everybody's had a chance, okay. All right, my impression is then that we're done. I would commend you all for the tenacity you had to sit through so much detail over the last 3 days. I hope it's been as useful to the participants in the conference as it has been to those of us here at the center, who have put it together, and I think you all recognize that what you saw today is really the result of a great maturing process, the result of a tremendous amount of work on the part of many, many people here who, in effect, support the presenters who actually gave you the information that we have available. One way I look on this is that what we've presented today, or in the last 3 days, is really a conceptual lunar mission with a large amount of data available in the presentations and behind the presentations. In other words, there's still more depths of detail to which we can go. The data available from which the trade-offs, which yet obviously have to be made in some areas, can be made on an intelligent, rational basis. I think I begin to feel, those of us down here begin to feel that we really, perhaps for the first time, are in a position to almost understand that to which we have been committed for the last 5 or 6 years. I think you can see in several cases, say particularly with respect to the lighting requirements on the landing itself, which turns out to be a major swing factor, that we're taking a relatively conservative approach. There are other areas of the program in which flexibility of that general kind is still included. We have a series of decisions to make, actually increasingly through the next 18 months or so, to which of these options we're going to use, and we're in a position again to hopefully intelligently or at least knowingly decide which ones we keep in and which ones we take out as we move forward. I think it also becomes pretty apparent that the bugaboo of big programs like this that use massive digital computers is with us, and that is that the software is at least as critical as the hardware. By and large, because we call it software, we have a tendency to think of it softly, think of it as being changeable at your whim, whereas as a matter of fact, it should be obvious that we will unfortunately never be in a position to have as much confidence in the qualification of the software as we will actually literally have in the qualification of the hardware, for two reasons: because the software comes late and because the software contains so many multiple paths of operation which you might get into in some sort of an anomalous situation, that it's almost literally impossible to run enough simulations to feel that you've gone through every possible permutation and combination. The number is almost literally infinity. That's not to say that we're giving up on the software problem or that it's insoluble. It's just that we must, because of some of the problems in the software, keep many of these multiple ways of looking at things from different sources and from different programs so that we're able to maintain checks and balances as we go on through the program. We haven't talked at all about the hardware, either launch vehicle or spacecraft. That's another whole symposium that's probably longer than 3 days, as a matter of fact. I might just summarize, for those of you who might not be in detail familiar with the program, with the fact that the 1B is already flying as a launch vehicle, that we are fairly far along in the checkout cycle of what hopefully will be the first manned command service module, and it will fly, I think, for sure early next year and possibly somewhat earlier than that, as long as there are no reporters in the room. The Saturn V, almost all the stages, I guess, have been delivered, at least first time through the factory, and the Saturn V will be flying early next year. The LEM, Lord willing, should fly about the second quarter of next year. The Block 2 CSM in summer of next year, and by that time we'll be in a position to be doing the best simulations of the lunar mission that we can do, joint spacecraft operation in Earth orbit, so that not much more than a year from now we'll be going into what are in effect the final dress rehearsals, the qualification testing in Earth orbit to do the lunar mission. And I think it's impossible to say how many times we're going to have to do that, how many problems we're going to have to work out, either from a hardware or from an operational point of view, before we're ready to go. But the capability on paper to do the lunar mission can be available to us within something like 18 months or a year and a half from now. And from there on, it's the question of evolution and development until we're sure we're ready to go. That means there is not very much time. There isn't much time for gross change. What we're doing now is, in effect, honing up, narrowing the field of decisions, and hopefully getting closer to the goal. I hope that the symposium was useful from that point of view. It's a little hard to say exactly how we tie this off. What we are suggesting is that all of the attendees, I was going to say feel free, but I think it's more strong than that, feel a strong obligation to review the results of these last 3 days. This has not been an entertainment in any sense, but rather a presentation of where we're going, the tracks that we're on, to people who are presumably the most competent people in the country to understand where there may perhaps be flaws, where there could be significant improvements made in the operation. I think you should all therefore feel an obligation to review the material which you've seen in the last 3 days at your leisure. Take a few weekends, get it done, and send your comments here to the center so that we may include them in our overall planning, and we may know indeed that you either agree or disagree with what's going on in the several areas that have been talked about. Such comments, editorial or critical, should be sent to Owen Maynard. He'll be the focal point for receiving and processing them here at the center. And all of the speakers, and in addition some people from Owen's shop, Batty, Severe, and Cohn, and Jenkins, Jess Garee, will be assigned the task of looking at each one of these, following them up, and either including them somewhere in our study program or giving a suitable answer as to why we don't have to do it. In addition, as we mentioned, the slides are being prepared. Slides, frankly, plus some additional material which we have not presented on things like some of the thermal constraints, like the contamination problems that we just haven't had time to go into. That material is prepared. I'm suggesting that it all be put together in a single document or several documents and mailed to you. That mailing should be accomplished sometime within the next 10 days or so. Aside from that, I guess we are done. If any of the senior management would care to add any comments, we'd be happy to have it. Eberhardt, you're about as senior as we have. Eberhardt would like an index of abbreviations, and I think that's a good idea. It's always the initial introduction to these things that are difficult. Any other comments, Sam?
I think the comment I'd like to make is to compliment MSC for an excellently done symposium and description of the lunar mission in considerable detail. I think MSC can be very proud of the progress that they've made with the hardware and the preparations for the lunar operation. I think anyone who had any doubt that it's a complex mission will leave here with that doubt dispelled. We are essentially committed to the plan for conducting the mission, as you can clearly see. There's a tremendous job ahead, and I agree completely with Joe's summary comments that there's a great deal of work in the software, the training, and in maturing our whole space system. Every opportunity we can take advantage of to make it easier or simpler surely will be important. And I, in conclusion, would like to reemphasize what Joe said about an obligation to comment, to submit your comments to MSC such that they can be taken advantage of in tying this off. Dr. Gilruth, Dr. Shea, everyone else, our compliments. I think these 3 days have done a lot to increase our understanding of the mission and of our confidence that we'll carry it out. Thanks a lot.
Okay, just one last point. We have a kind of running transcript of the questions and answers that have gone on through the symposium up through Mr. Kincaid's talk this morning. That's available to you as you leave. That's as far as we got. Okay. Thank you.